And now give a nice warm welcome to our 10-minute speaker.
Good evening. My name is Don. I am an alcoholic. I've been an alcoholic for a long time, and I'll be an alcoholic again tomorrow. But I'm recovered now, and I'm recovered because of this program and the 12 steps and the good people that I think brought me the 12 steps in the beginning. So let's get some things out of the way. I don't like podiums, and I like the idea that there's no microphone here so I can move around if I want to talk, right? Alright. I heard a comment earlier that said that, the reason you're here, Don, is to keep Marcy honest. And, I have to be very honest about it. My wife's here, so she's here to keep me honest. This meeting is going to be the truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. Alright? From the time I picked up my first drink in my pre-teens or early teens until the time I put my last drink down, I was always in trouble with somebody. I was either the United States Navy, my parents, local authorities, or my wife. I never drank, I never understood social drinking. I drank for effect. And I was always trying to hide something. As I come to find out later in my life, I was hiding my inadequacies instead of where I thought I was trying to be part of the group. Most of us can identify with that type of drinking. I told you I was always in trouble with somebody. I didn't volunteer for this program. I did not wake up one morning and say, God, I've had enough. I had enough, and I knew it, but I didn't have the guts to say it. I got captured in a DUI, and before the night was over, I was in a resisting arrest and attempted jailbreak. And it was not the first time that things like that happened to me while I was drinking. And this judge in Goose Creek, South Carolina said, he told the short patrol officer, said, this guy needs some help, all right? And he said, I think you need to take him off and let him see the psychiatrist. Through a series of circumstances, I never made it to that psychiatrist. The Navy had a hospital on the fifth floor. It was a psychiatric wing. On the B side, on the A side was the alcohol rehab ward. And some chief on a tender where I was had to go get the, you can't just go see a psychiatrist, you got to get a referral. I never understood that. But you got to have a referral for some of these positions and stuff like that. Some chief says, Sid, I don't think you're nuts. I think you got a drinking problem, So I wound up on the A side. And what happened is I sat down at a table with a guy that turned out to be my first sponsor. And he asked me some of the dumbest damn questions I've ever heard in my life. He said, how much do you drink? And I'm a sailor. I drink, and it depends on how much money I got. One of the things that we did in the Navy, married men, we never told our wives how much money we made. Right? We never told them about, I'm in a combat zone now, so I get an extra $65 a month. Or I get my mail sent free or something like that. We never told the truth, It wasn't, we just give them allotments and told them, well, that's all it is here, And I got my little pendants here to live off of. And that's the way it was in my house, what happened after I got put in that rehab, there was a circumstances that, that took place in my house that people are going to prison for now, Spousal abuse was not really a big deal back then. And if it would have been, I would have been locked up for a long time. Child abuse was the same way. I would have been locked up for a long time. But I got into Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning, and I didn't really know if I wanted to be here. I went to this rehab unit. It was 6 weeks long. And I thought, I'll just check into the hospital. 6 weeks, I'll check out, and everything will be fine. No. I checked into the hospital, and it's 6 o'clock that night, 7 o'clock that night. They put me in the back of a station wagon with seven other sailors that just checked in that day and drove us 2 blocks to our first AA. We could have walked it. They wanted to make damn sure we got there. And that's the kind of drunks we were. And I wound up in that AA meeting, and I don't know if I was impressed or what. I don't remember. It was too much of a fault, but we kept going to meetings every night. And one of the meetings of Rural Bethel was, we went to a place called Monk's Corner, South Carolina. And there was four old timers in there, about Max's age. You know? But there was four old timers in there, and they were sitting there before the meeting, and they were talking about these ride lawnmowers, how this guy that designed this ride lawnmower, somebody would have done the world a favor if he'd have cut his throat before he got that thing on paper and put it on the, you know, sold it to some great distract or somebody to make this kind of thing. And it was a mess. And they were talking about how bad these ride lawnmowers was, and they were sitting in that room, and there were seven of us, like I said. We were facing court martials, divorces, and anything else you could think of in a military system. And I thought, God, if that's the only problem they got is how to get that damn ride lawnmower started, maybe I'll listen to these people. You know? So I changed my attitude, and I went to meetings. I changed my attitude about going to meetings. And I learned to listen a little bit. That guy that was through the intake on me was much, like I said, he turned to be my first sponsor. He pushed the steps. I fought him. He pushed the steps. I fought him. He got steps 1, 2, and 3 out of me. And it was about a year later, they got step 4 out of me when I was in Italy. At one time, I thought, you know, maybe there was a clinical psychologist that running here. He was a civilian. But with a stroke of a pen, this guy could put me out of the Navy. And I called my sponsor, I was standing watching on a ship, and we was in port. And I called him up about 11 o'clock at night, just before I was getting off watching. Across the pier there, there was the AC Ducey Club, and it was a Friday night, and the band was rocking, and boy, I was getting thirsty. It was hot. It was hot on that deck, you know, and I called old DT up, and I said, you know, I think Mr. Snyder might have made a mistake, Gil. I know Gil might have made a mistake, and he says, how's that? And I said, I think I might be crazy. I might not be alcoholic. And Bob reminded me of this story today when I was up at Central Office, and he says, you know something, Don? He says, crazy people shouldn't drink either, and then he hung that one. So I was guilty in both parts. I was alcoholic, and I was crazy. My wife at the time, she thought revenge was more fun than a divorce, better served, you know. We started out from there. And one of the other things, if you're new in the program, you've got a wife that's sitting at home, and like mine was in the beginning, we started going to meetings together. Even though it was an AA meeting, it was an open AA meeting, you know. And they were there. And we used to go to that meeting, and on Friday night, after a while, that was our date. I went to an AA meeting, and she went down the hall to an Al-Anon meeting. And about the only thing we could afford at that time was that strawberry pie that we used to get at Bob's Big Boy, and a cup of coffee after that meeting. And my finances were a mess. She was pregnant with our fourth child. I had three other ones that I found out, and I got introduced to him on Wednesday night when she started going down and on, and I had to take care of him. You know? And over the period of time here, we've raised them kids, and they're out of the house now. And all of it has to do, you know, they didn't get better. They were all right to begin with. It was Dawn that was getting better. I'd run across people that would come up with these things, and you know, the subject last night at the meeting was just listening. And they would come up with things like, you know, how do you treat your wife? Do you treat her like your best friend? And my wife came at me that way. Do you love me? I said, I love you. She said, no, do you like me? I said, no, I love you. She said, why don't you treat me like you treat them people in Alcoholics Anonymous, like your friends there? And that was a big girl. I used to get them little spiritual spirits, you know, periodically. I still do, you know. The key to this program is the ability to read the first 164 pages of this book, all right, and then interpret it into your life. And the other thing is to go to your meetings and listen. Because there's going to be a nut like being up here one day talking to me, you know. I don't know if I'm talking to anybody in this room tonight. Or not, it's okay I'm up here because God and Rich wants me up here tonight. You know. It's been a fabulous program. It's been a program for me for the last 38 years. I've had 39 years of sobriety. in August. Alright. And it ain't always been fun, but it's always been real. You know. I still have a sponsor. I still have a man I call a sponsor. He's a friend, you know. I still have the first wife that I ever married, you know. We jokingly kid each other that we're slow because we're still, after 48 years, we're still married, you know. And we're going to have our fourth great grandchild in April, not her birthday. Oh, gosh. I get grandkids every year. I've been out of the Navy now since 1989. There hasn't been a summer in my house that wasn't a grandchild or a great-grandchild there through summer. And then they're up there always, you know, ready to go. What are you going to do this summer? I'm going to Granny's. You know? And why are they going to go to Granny's? Because Papa's going to take a swim. Papa's going to do that, you know? And you taught me out here in my college mother. You taught me how to be a grandparent. You taught me how to be a husband. You taught me how to be a father, you know? I have one child of my own that has not seen me drinking. You know, and I like to say, boy, that's just great, but she's the one that might have the disease. And so I don't know if it's genetic, I don't know if it's hereditary. I know that she's, you know, it ain't up to me to figure that out. It's up to me to do that to show you. When you ask the question where you need to go, I know where to send her, you know. I think my 2 minutes is up, and I want to thank everybody for inviting me here, and I hope you have a good week. Thank you.
Okay, give Marcy a big hand.
You people.
My name's Marcy and I am an alcoholic. I did say my name is Marcy, but I feel like Forrest Gump up here. I don't know. You know, tonight it's going to be interesting. I was looking around the room and I see so many people who have been so instrumental in my recovery. And tonight you're going to hear me talk about a little bit about my dad. And my father died with 32 years of sobriety. You're going to hear me talk a little bit about my lovely wife, Susan, the love of my life. And you're going to hear me talk about my sponsor. We'll get to that later. And you know, a couple of weeks ago, my friend Abraham was at a meeting, and he says, I'm not a big thumper, nor do I want to be. And I tell you what, I really relate to that. I wouldn't know how to be. But I want to tell you a little bit about, for me, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And if there's anything that I say up here that anybody can use, I encourage you to take it with you. If there's anything that I say up here that you disagree with, well, that's your privilege, your prerogative, just leave it here. I wouldn't be up here if you weren't out there, I guarantee you that. And this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has really, really been a blessing to me. And I've learned so much from all of you. And my friend Mike from Exeter oftentimes talks about how, you know, we don't hear enough about how this is such a deadly disease. And I totally agree with him. I know that for me, I knew the progression of my disease of alcoholism. And I know that if I had not been blessed to find these doors, I would absolutely be dead today because of my behaviors. And I thank you, Mike, for reminding me of that. Because it is so, so true. I know that I'm one of those alcoholics that you know, all it's going to take for me is to make one bad choice, have one drink, and I'd be off and running. And I know this because of some of the other things that happened in my life. You know, for an example, I've got a daughter who, you know, she chooses to smoke, and she was visiting us, and she left a pack of cigarettes at my house. And I was, and she left, and I was in one of those moods where I was hungry, angry, lonely, and tired, and all of the above. And I saw that pack of cigarettes out on the patio, and I haven't smoked in 12 or 14 years. I lost track a long time ago. But I remember I went out there, and I saw that pack of cigarettes, and it scared me to death. And I called my sponsor up, and I said, there's a pack of cigarettes in here, and I want to smoke so bad, just we'll throw them away. So I hung the phone up, and I went out, and I threw them in the trash. And then that was a bad mistake for people like me. Right, Mike? And so I knew what I had to do. I went and I felt like a dumpster diver. I was. And I got that pack of cigarettes out and I took it underneath the water faucet and I just shriveled it up and, you know, got rid of it. Because that's the only thing that would work for me. Because you let me have one bottle of beer in the house for company or a bottle of wine or something like that, that's not healthy for me. It might be for you, but it's not for me. I can't have it around. And so I do take that real serious for me. But, you know, here I am talking about alcoholism, and I don't know, there are a lot of people who have been here for a lot of years, and then maybe there are some people who have been here just for a few weeks, a few months. But some of us may have forgotten, or maybe some of us don't understand, you know, what an alcoholic is. And I want to take just a moment to tell you what I believe an alcoholic is. And I want you to think about... Well, first of all, I'd like to ask the question, were there any bar drinkers here? Do you like to drink in bars? Okay, yeah, a whole bunch of you guys, right? But I want you to think about this. I want you to think about a normal person. And this normal person goes into a bar and orders a beer. It's hot, summertime, and so he tells the bartender he wants a beer, and the bartender brings over this big, frosty glass and fills it up, and the foam just flops over the side, and ice slithers down. And then he's just taking a deep breath, getting ready to enjoy it, and all of a sudden this great big horsefly comes flying, and it goes plop, and it lands right in that foam of that beer. Well, the normal drinker, he takes, and he calls the bartender over, and he says, you know, there's a fly in my beer. And the bartender says, I am so sorry. And he takes it, and he throws it away, and brings him another one. This is on the house. But then alcoholics, the only reason I'm telling the joke is because last night Jesus told me a joke and I thought it was funny to tell. So, an alcoholic goes into a bar and he orders a beer. And the bartender brings this big beer, the ice just slithers down the side, the foam just, you know, frothing over the top. And I'll be darned if here doesn't come another big old horse fly. And that big old horse fly goes... Drop and it slams right at the top of that foam of that beer. And the alcoholic kind of looks around and he takes his fingers and he goes down inside of that foam and he finds that fly and he puts his fingers around that fly's throat and says, spit it out, damn it, spit it out. So, you know, I relate to that. I don't know if you do or not, but I relate to that. And, a lot of people have accused me of being too serious, so that's why I did that. I want you to know that I'm not the least bit upset right now. My sponsor yelled at me on the way over here, and he said, you got 20 minutes to get over it. And so it's been pretty tough today. I want you to know it's been pretty tough today. And you know, a lot of times... you know, people want to know a little bit about you, you know, like what it was like. And, you know, I'm going to share a little bit about what it was like in my family. And, you know, because every experience that I went through as a child, whatever those experiences were, contributed to the person I am today. And so that's the only reason that I'm sharing some of these things. And I think... all of us are aware of there are certain things that are only appropriate. I'm speaking for myself. There are things that are only appropriate for God and my sponsor to hear. And you won't be hearing any of that stuff tonight. Mike, no. And, but I want to share just a little bit about who Marky was, when he was little, and some things that happened. And as I said, my father died with 32 years of continued sobriety. And the wonderful thing of it is my father was a wonderful, wonderful man. He had the disease of alcoholism. And I won't go into all the Oklahoma stuff when they came out, but around my house, all I knew, not all I knew, but most of what I knew was yelling and screaming and fighting and that sort of thing, from my parents. And I'm the youngest of 8 children. And my oldest brother died of alcoholism at 42 years old. And, the grandparents on both sides were alcoholics. And here's the word that I haven't heard in a long time, and I was just thinking of it today, is that my father and mother, when they would get into a fight, they would call each other's mother and each other's father a word called a sot. And I don't really remember that word. I think that just meant old drunk or something like that. I'm not real sure. But at any rate, growing up as a child, some of the things that I just wanted to share with, I was made to do a lot of things that I wasn't really comfortable doing. For an example, I was sharing at a meeting the other day that we didn't have a game warden up in the mountains until my family moved up there. And to feed such a large family, my father used to shoot a lot of deer. And my father would be drunk, and he would be driving the roads up at Glenville, and he would shoot his deer. And then he would come back to the house, and he would pick up myself and my older brother. And he would take us out, and we would have to climb the fences, and we would have to go out there, and we would have to bleed the deer, we'd have to get the deer, and then we'd have to lay down in the grass that was about that tall while game wardens and ranchers went by with their spotlights looking for us. And we were scared to death, all the time, just scared to death. And on this one particular occasion, I came home from school, and my father and mother are fighting in the kitchen, and my father has a pocket knife up to his throat. And I didn't know then what he wanted, but he wanted some more money so he could go down to the old Curvin Club in Strathmore. And remember that one? And my mom didn't have the money. And I can remember Daddy putting his knife up to his throat and threatening to kill himself, and my sister and I grabbing a hold of Daddy's legs and saying, "No, Daddy, don't, and Mama would say, "Oh, he's too big of a coward, he's not going to do that." But as a 5 or 6 year old, you don't know what he's going to do. And then I can remember that night going to bed and waking up in the middle of the night to a lot of noise. And I got up, and I saw blood all over the living room floor, all over the kitchen, and when I went in the bathroom, there was an unknown object in the bathtub, and it was just blood. And I screamed, and I just went into hysterics, and my older brothers came and got me, and what had happened is my dad had shot a deer and brought it home and gutted it in the bathtub. And the trauma that I experienced that day, kind of filtered over that night. So that's kind of the stuff that my family went through, stuff like that. And and then going to school, I can remember always having to wear my brother's shirts and my brother's socks and my brother's whatever, anything that my brothers had, I was left over, I had. And I can remember once a year they had the health department that would come and they would check you for lice. And they would check your ears and your eyes and all that kind of stuff. And when they would come, I didn't know when they were going to come, and I knew that I had holes in my socks. And so while everybody else was getting waved and all the little rich rancher boys up there pulling off the cowboy boots and everything, and here I had these tennis shoes that had these big old holes in the bottom of them, and socks that had big old holes in them and full of dirt and stuff. And I can remember I would tell my teacher, "I got a stomach ache, I got to go to the bathroom." So I would sneak out, and I would go back there, and I would find some straight pins on the bulletin board. And I would hide around the corner, and I'd take my sock, and I'd pull it down and underneath and tape it, or not tape it, but pin it, so it looked like I had nice, pretty socks on top. And so I got away with that, for a little while, that type of stuff. And, I found alcohol, probably when I was about 13, 14 years old. And we kind of laughed at a meeting the other night because Trucker John was the first one that ever gave me a shot of anything stronger than beer. And I was 14 and he was 16, and we were laughing about that at a meeting the other night. And as I look back, I thought, you know, I had some issues with alcohol long, long before I thought I did. And that's kind of how it was, you know. And Albert, I'm only going to use this word one time. The deal of it is, fast forwarding a little bit, you know, when I found alcohol, and I could go into like most of us, you know, a lot of stories about what it was like and everything, or you know, about the family and all that stuff. But the one thing, one of the many things about Alcoholics Anonymous that I adore is the fact that there are solutions here. And so I want to get more to the solutions, you know. And, you know, I hear people use the expression, you know, alcohol kicked my butt and all that kind of stuff. But I will tell you this. I started making extremely bad choices. You know, I spent some time in the military. And after I got out of the military, I got married to my childhood sweetheart. And we started having children, you know, very rapidly. And I loved my childhood sweetheart with all my heart. And those of you who know me well in my inner circle, and there aren't too many people that I allow in my inner circle, you know that when I love with all my heart. That's all I can say is I love with all my heart. And I love that first wife with all my heart. Unfortunately, years later, we grew apart. And then, lucky for me, I found the love of my life, and I've had her for 15 years. That's Susan. And but with that first wife, my first two children, I can remember little things like living up in Springs or Three Rivers and taking them for little walks, and going out to the lake, having one little baby in each arm like this. And this one time, I was walking out in the lake, and I had been drinking quite a bit that morning, and I remember I fell in a hole, and my two children, I'm trying to hold them up, keep them from drowning. And it was just by the grace of God that some little girl happened to be walking by, and she grabbed one of my little boys, and I got the other one out. And if that little girl hadn't been there, I would have been the cause of those two little boys drowning. And then after I got over the fear, go back to the same behavior, you know, the same drinking and things of that nature. Just one other little situation where alcohol took me. I couldn't wait until my wife left town, because that's when I could really do the deal. And we had horses, always loved to ride and everything. Well, I was one of those types of guys where my wife would have a horse saddled up, because she figured if I came home from work and took a ride, you know, everything would be cool. I wouldn't be as stressed, and I wouldn't drink as much and all that kind of stuff. But I was one of those guys that I would take a bottle of whiskey and I would put it at one end of Strathmore in an orange tree, and then I would go to the other end of Strathmore and put another bottle of whiskey in another fork of an orange tree. And then I would come home, my wife would have the horse all saddled, thank you very much, sweetheart, and I'd get on my horse, and I'd take off and I'd go down to that orange tree, and maybe a little bottle of whiskey, ride down to that orange tree like that. And she could never figure out why I was schnockered, you know, when I got home. But that's kind of how it was. And one time she left for a couple of weeks because she would do her little geographic. She would go to try to find herself, discover herself. And by this time she had gotten actively involved in Al-Anon. And she threatened to take my boys to Al-Anon. Can you figure that one out? And I can remember just so happy because she left and I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And I think I had three children during that time, and maybe four, I can't remember. Three, I think. And so I ended up having, we had five, and wonderful, wonderful young men today. But I can remember passing out on the couch in October, and you thought I was going to say I woke up in November, but that's all. I passed out on the couch, and we had a wood-burning stove, and I was passed out. The boys were cold and hungry, and they wanted to make some quesadillas and some stuff like that. So they built a fire in the wood-burning stove, and I was not aware of that. Well, the next thing I know, my next-door neighbor, who lived a few houses down, he comes running over there and he's pounding on the door and he's taking my little boys out. The next thing I know, I'm hearing sirens and the roof of the garage is smoking. And they caught the roof on fire because the smokestack got so thin. Would you believe that we had a CPS investigation over that? And just little things like that. And so when my wife came back, she kicked me out of the house for a couple of weeks, and just some uncomfortable stuff. But, you know, I don't want to talk a whole bunch about the problems anymore. I want to talk a little bit about the solutions, at least the solutions as I found them in my life. And my wife, she kept trying to convince me that that I had a problem with alcohol. I knew I had a problem with alcohol. But I drank to cope with life's problems because I did not know how to cope with life at all. I didn't drink to party or to have a good time or anything like that because I was a lone drinker. And but I drank, and I had to stay on this particular level all the time, right here. I would wake up in the morning, and I would have a routine like a lot of people do, but I'd pour two big old iced tea glasses of Carl Rossi Burgundy, and I'd drink that stuff until I felt just warm. And then I'd get a little cup of coffee, and I'd walk around the house with that. And then I loved Seagram 7, and then I loved gin, and just about anything else. But I had certain liquors that would do certain things to me at certain times of the day. And I got real good at that and knew exactly, you know, what it would take and how much it would take to get me right here. And I stayed right here. You know, all my drinking life, I stayed right here. And the last bit of embarrassment that occurred to my wife was the Baptist church in this particular town that we lived in invited us to a Valentine's dance. And I did not know how I was possibly going to go 2 hours without a drink. Didn't know how that was going to happen. And so I took a half pint of gin, put it in the top of my cowboy hat, and I put masking tape across it. Put it on my head. The band started up. We started dancing. And my hat flew off. And that bottle just went dancing across the floor by itself. And everybody is just looking at me and deny, deny, deny. It didn't belong to me. And I'm finally sitting in the front seat, and a well-known person who sings and does some stuff was performing, and I had nodded off in the front seat or front chair. And he comes over and he knocks me on the head. He says, "Not, not, Marcy, am I putting you to sleep?" You know, and it just embarrassed the whole house, embarrassed my wife and everything like that. So she got kind of tired of that. And I just briefly, you know, got to say this, but Mike doesn't understand how anybody can break a whole gallon of Carl Rossi Burgundy up against an olive tree. But March 15th of 1988, I decided I didn't like me anymore. And I had been in some inappropriate relationships with women other than my wife. And that was the one thing that I said I would never, ever do. But I did. And suddenly my, whether it was conscience, whatever it might be, I don't know. But I can remember March 15th of 1988, I was going out to Tonyville to meet a particular young lady, old lady actually. Very old lady. But she had money. And, you know, this sounds dramatic, but I pulled my vehicle off into the olive grove over there, just on this side of Tonyville, and I didn't like me anymore. I just didn't like me. And I got out of the car, and I busted that jug of Carl Ross Burgundy up against that olive tree, and then I had a half pint of Imperial whiskey underneath there, and I did take one little nip out of it before I poured it out. And I said, "That's it, no more." And you know, our big book talks about swearing off with and without a solemn oath. And I did that many times. And this time, I got out of my vehicle and I got down on my knees right there on that olive grove. And I did not care whether the police chief or the Pope came by. I said, God, I can't do this by myself. I was in church every Sunday. And I couldn't wait till one of my boys had to go pee-pee. Because my wife sat at one end and I had four or five little boys in between us. And then when one of them had to go pee-pee, I'd have to take him out. And it would give me the perfect opportunity to lift up my cowboy boot and take a little nip out of that imperial whiskey that was in that little half pint in my boot. Now, normal people don't do that, I don't suppose, but I did. This one day, I went in. He says, no, Daddy. He says, I don't have to pee-pee, I have to potty. So I opened up the stall, and as I'm opening up the stall, there's a man in the restroom, and he's doing a line of cocaine across the porcelain of the bathroom in church. Well, I knew very little about stuff like that, but I knew what he was doing. And the ironic thing, he takes part in my later recovery, but what happened was that day in the olive grove, I got down on my knees and I said, God, I can't do this by myself anymore. And you know, I think about what, you know, we have these videos and writings and stuff about how Bill felt, you know, when he had his spiritual awakening and what he experienced. And I looked up there at those mountains while I was on my knees, and I can remember to this day, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I can remember what those clouds looked like up there, and I can remember what those foothills looked like. And I got back in my car, and I started crying like a baby. I did not know what I was going to do, where I was going to go. And somehow, I ended up over at a man's house who was very active in the fellowship. And I knocked on his door, and I said, Jerry, I said, sometime when you have time, I want to talk to you about my drinking. And I thought he was going to make an appointment for me or something, but he said, how about right now? And he brought me in the house, and he we talked, then we went out and we got coffee, and we sat out in the Orange Grove till very late at night. And he shared his experiences, his strengths, and his hopes with me, and he says, you don't ever have to live like that again. He says, now tomorrow night there's a meeting up in Springville. He says, I won't be able to be there, but he says, I'm going to send somebody up there. And he says, whatever you do, don't do your routine tomorrow morning. So when I woke up in the morning, it was the first time that I could ever remember that I did not drink in the morning. I did not go out and have a pitcher of beer with the Pizza Hut, you know, at lunch. I did not embezzle any money from my boss. And I had done that for 14 years. I went home that night, took a shower, got dressed, and my wife said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to an AA meeting up at Springville. And she looked at me like, yeah, right. But I did. I went to that meeting. And when I went to that meeting, I walked in the door, and there was a man who was standing there. And he held up this big book, and he said, you got one of these? And I said, no, I don't. And it was that same man that had done that line of cocaine 2 years before in the bathroom. I looked across the room, and there was this cowboy over there. Well, he looked like a cowboy to me. He was, today I can say he was a wannabe cowboy. But don't you ever tell him I said that. But a couple of years before, I was in one of those melancholy moods after I got out of church, and I went over to the Parr Center in Porterville, and I thought, I want to, you know, do something about my drinking and all this kind of stuff. They made a suggestion that I go to a meeting that night. So I went over to this meeting, and I had my van, and I had a beer in my left hand, and I had my door open, and it was dark, and I was urinating in the parking lot with my right hand. And all of a sudden, this guy comes over and puts his hand on my shoulder. I turned around and swing at him, and he says, you hit me, son, and I'll hit you back. And it was that cowboy. And so needless to say, I didn't go into that meeting. So it was probably a couple of years later when I did go into that meeting in Springville. And I'm looking over there, and there's this guy there, and he looked like a blowtorch. And his name was Jerry, and he had on a yellow shirt, and his face was just beet red. And remember that ugly shirt he used to wear? And at any rate, I thought, boy, I'm staying away from that one. And at any rate, after the meeting, the cowboy came over and he said, "You got a drinking problem, son?" And I looked at him and he says, "You know, recovery works if you don't drink." And it was that same cowboy, you know, that same person that I met in the parking lot. And he later became my my first sponsor. And what happened there was a total miracle at that very first meeting. And what happened was there were people just like some of you in here. And as a matter of fact, some of you were there at that first meeting. And you gave me your phone numbers. And you said, "Keep coming back." And you said, "You know, this thing works, you know, if you really work it." And then they made those suggestions, like my sponsor said, you know, that first 104 pages, and start reading those things. And they made me really feel welcome. And they just made all kinds of suggestions. And I don't know, I guess I was just ready. I was just ready. And I listened, you know. And you know what? I did a lot of whining, a lot of sniveling, you know, during those first few months. And it was my third week at that meeting, and I was sitting in one chair, that lady right there, Cheryl, was sitting in another chair, and there was a man between us. That man flopped out of his chair and started going into seizures right there. And she sent me to the kitchen to get a towel, and I come back, and she and I are performing whatever the hell we were doing to him. And all I know, he was puking all over us and stuff. And she reaches over and she pats me on the shoulder and she says, "Welcome to AA." And so anyway, that's the way that went. But you know, you just kept saying, "Marcy, you know, we've got this activity going and we've got that activity going," and you encouraged me to come and participate. Well, somehow you suckered me into the kitchen. And so I started helping with the speaker's breakfast, and I've been a part of that breakfast for the majority of 22 years. And I love it. You know, I love it. It's really, really enjoyable. It's even more enjoyable whenever we have, you know, John and Mike Potts on rare occasions when he can come to the kitchen and not talk and work. And of course, my sponsor, Don, I turned him into a monster when I introduced him to the grill. And he's making omelets this Sunday, incidentally, up there. And then Max has been known to be in there during crisis times, as well as Eddie. And so it's just really neat how everybody just pitches in and comes and helps. And that's just what makes the fellowship. That's just what makes it so much fun. But there came a time when, in my recovery, when I had to change directions, and I, God put another qualified sponsor in my life, and I did not do my part nearly as much as I should have, and I placed a lot of blame on that second sponsor, and we grew differently. I've since been able to go back and make amends to that sponsor for my part of that behavior, and it was just a difficult growing period for both of us. And I find that God just puts special people in your life, you know, when you need them, you know, and everybody that's been in my life has been there for a purpose, for a reason, and they give me what he wants me to have, you know, at that time. And I really appreciate that. And, you know, there was a situation where I became extremely miserable about 3 years ago. I didn't like what I had become in sobriety. I had, and I do not recommend this, but I had some issues that I had never dealt with because I didn't know how to deal with them. Or perhaps I was afraid to deal with them. I don't know. But I had some issues that were absolutely killing me. Absolutely killing me. And God put someone else in my life. And I love, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are so many wonderful, wonderful things that have helped me out in here so much. But I just love the chapter into action. I absolutely love the chapter into action. And I love what I hear and what I read about I must be entirely honest, you know, with another person. That was probably the most frightening thing I ever had to experience in my life, was to be entirely honest. You know, I thought I was, you know, I thought I did a pretty good job, you know, the first few years, you know, my recovery. But suddenly there comes a time, you know, when it's all about uncover, discover, and discard. I say that right? And I got to a point in my recovery where I was hurting so bad that, you know, I hear people tell me, and I believe it if they say it, I've got no reason not to believe it. They say things like, the obsession has just left me. And I respect that, and I say, I'm happy for them. And then people say, if you don't feel that way, it's because you didn't do a thorough third step and all this kind of stuff. And it gets a little bit mind-boggling for me. I'm just a dumb alcoholic, you know. I just like to keep it simple, you know. And, you know, I know what works for me and what doesn't work for me. And, you know, the thing, the deal of it is I have learned so much about me these last 3 years by the workshops that I have gone to. And by just approaching life a little bit different. I don't know. I'm not proud of it. I don't even know if it's how I really feel about this. I really don't know. But I would have to say that I came as close to not being the I want to say nice person that I am capable of being. I came real close to being someone that you would not want me to have in your inner circle. My attitude sucked because I had so much fear inside of me. I had so much fear. I believe that, this is just one for me anyway, is when God puts people into my life, I found for me is I have choices. And I had to take a risk. I had to put every ounce of trust and every ounce of honesty that I could muster up, I had to put every ounce of that into the hands of my sponsor. And boy, you don't think that's a risk. And I can remember feeling so uncomfortable about life. I can be very, very canic. I can be a very, very hateful person. And a lot of people look at me and they're really, really surprised when I say things like that. But I have a horrendous temper. And I haven't shown it in a very, very long time. But this behavior was on the verge of coming out about 3 years ago. And because I don't like to use this word in a church or anything, but I'm going to use it anyway. It was either shit or get off the pot. And that's what it was, you know, what happened. And I knew that I had to have a totally clean slate. Or I just could not go on in Alcoholics Anonymous comfortably. You know, I could lie to you and everybody else if I chose to, which I didn't, but I couldn't lie to me anymore. I couldn't lie to my God. And so I knew that with the qualified sponsor that I chose at that time, or God put in my life, whatever the situation was, I knew that I had to be 100% honest. And I can remember I hurt so bad that I started avoiding him. And I'm saying some things to you that I hope you don't do, so you can save yourself a heck of a lot of pain. And I can remember I started avoiding him, and I started hurting so bad. And I went to a couple of people, and I said to those people in that outer circle, I said, you really think I can trust him? Because they knew him better than I did. And I was assured, yeah, you can trust him. And, okay, whatever. And I remember the pain got so bad that I got so desperate that I had two choices. And I remember this. Just absolutely two choices. I wanted to put everything in my backpack and just take off. Or I wanted to face the music. And I prayed about it. And prayer was a big deal in my life. A big deal in my life. So I got down on my knees up at the lake up there. I've got a little serenity spot up there that I go to. My spot, it's not yours, and I'm not going to tell you. And I got down on my knees and I asked God for direction. And I can remember I called my sponsor up and I said, you know, I know you're going to be going to San Diego, but when you get back, when you have time, you know, can we get together? I really need to talk, you know, to you. And I was there again. I was expecting to make an appointment. And he says, no, I'm not going to San Diego. He says, you meet at my house at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, oh, crap. I didn't sleep at all that night. And I went there that next morning, and we sat across the table from each other. And, you know, I talk about a lot of things unashamed. And it's the fact that... Anyway, there just aren't too many people in my inner circle, but I tell you what, I love my sponsor with all my heart. And I reached over and he grabbed my hands and we said a prayer together. And I can remember, he says, now what is it you want to tell me in God? And I was able to share some events that I had been holding all of my life. And I just absolutely knew from the very depths of my heart that my sponsor was going to banish me to the far corners of the earth. And that didn't happen. And the strange thing of it was is he looked me in the eye. And I was able to look him in the eye. And I knew that it was okay. I knew that it was okay. And he says, now, this is what we do with that. And we walked over to the couch, and we did the sixth and the seventh step together as we knelt down. And then he looked over at me, and he says, now, we never have to talk about these things unless you choose to. He says, we don't need to pick at scabs. He says, God has those things today. And I cannot tell you what a weight was lifted off of my shoulders. And, you know, 23 years ago, Vic was already told me, he said, I must be entirely honest with another human being. Guess what? Took that long. I don't suggest anybody wait that long. And life is good today. And, you know, I don't want to do anything to screw up my marriage. And so I work on that very, very hard. I don't want to do anything to screw up the quality of friendship that I have with so many of you in this room. I work on it very, very hard. I know that I'm an alcoholic. I know that all it's going to take for me is one drink. I'm gone. You know, I'm absolutely gone. I will tell you this. I am a very needy person. I am a very sincere person. And I make some bad choices, you know, in recovery. But my sponsor has taught me so many things when I'm willing to listen. I start my day out with something that's relatively new these past couple of years. I do what we call affirmations. And there are some very special things that I say in the morning that are very personal, you know, for me. I do review my day gone by at night when I go to bed. And I ask God's direction. And my second best female friend told me a couple of years ago something that she had heard over the coast. She says, does it need to be said? Does it need to be said by me? Does it need to be said by me today? And I use that every single day of my life. And it helps me to keep my mouth shut. And it helps me to listen. But I know that this disease is waiting for me. It is waiting for me. And it's kind of like, you know, we talk about, you know, God on this side, the devil on this side. You know, it's kind of how it is for me. I know for a fact. You know, last summer it was 112 degrees or something like that for about 5 days. And I can be a compulsive eater when I want to be. Albert loves to take me to hometown buffet because he just loves to see me eat. And there's a little place in Farmersville called La Mejor. And I love that place. Love that little place over there, La Mejor. And I went in there after work. I think it was a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, I'm not sure. And right there on the floor is a great big tub full of ice. I never drank a Corona in my life, but it was full of Coronas. And it had sliced lemons and salt stuff on a little pedestal right there. I walked in there. I was hungry. I was angry. I was lonely. And I was extremely tired. And when I saw that, I could taste the lemon in my mouth. I could taste the salt in my mouth. And I could taste everything else. And I turned around and I walked out. And I said, God, I just take this feeling away from me. And it did. It happened. And I know, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but, you know, it's cunning, it's baffling, and it's powerful. And it's out there, and it's just waiting for me. You know, it's just waiting for me. And, you know, I guess God got me right where he wants me because I have a daily reprieve from this disease, you know. And so that's why for me I have to, you know, keep a close conscious contact with God. And this past 2 years, it's been necessary for me to expand my horizons and explore different meetings in different areas to learn new things, you know, to learn new things, to hear new things. And I just thank each and every one of you. My God, I couldn't do this. I couldn't do this thing. This is truly a wee program. You know, I absolutely do. And you know, I just love it when I have people that I truly care about in this program. When they'll come up to me and they'll say, you know, I'm sorry that things aren't going too well in that area. Maybe you ought to try this. And that's that networking that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Matt gave my sponsor some tapes a few months ago, and my sponsor gave them to me, and I've been listening to those tapes, you know, going back and forth. And I was sharing with Matt tonight, I said, God, I'm so grateful that you gave us those tapes because I've always wanted to learn just a little bit more about the Washingtonians and the Oxford group and some of the, you know, pre-Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, as we have today. And so I do thank you for that, Matt. It's absolutely wonderful. And I don't want to, I couldn't think of anything else constructive to say. Not that I've said anything constructive, but, you know, what I share right now is that's who I was, that's what happened, and this is how it is today. And you know, my wife says it better than anybody I've ever heard. She says, you've got to want to stay sober more than you want to drink. And I absolutely believe that with all my heart. And you know, the wonderful thing about this deal is, you know, the wonderful thing about this, as far as I'm concerned, is I can look at so many people in here. I could go back to Bob, to Cheryl, to Max, to my grand sponsor Eddie. I could go back to any of you guys, if my sponsor and John and God, I could just go on and on. I could go back to any of you guys anytime, and I feel safe right now, you know, sharing things with you and David. And there's things that you have that I want. And, you know, it's, I don't want to miss the miracles, you know, of this fellowship, of what's going on here. And, You know, so for me, I'm just going to keep coming back, and maybe someday I'll be as happy, joyous, and free as I see a lot of you being in here. And all that takes is for you to continue coming back. And when I was with Eddie when he celebrated his 40 years of continued sobriety recently, you know, I had so much gratitude. And Jan, you know, so much gratitude, you know, for you people that have been around so long and you just keep coming back, and you're a testimony to me that this fellowship really works. You know, it's out there and it's free. And for that, I'm forever grateful. And I want to thank you for inviting me here to share a little bit about what's going on. And, you know, my sponsor said two things recently that I absolutely adore and love. He says to me, many things, but he said, God loves you and so do I. Thank you.